Just before you start listening to this podcast, a reminder that we have a special subscription offer. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher if you'd like to get this offer.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots and our Saturday edition. So, after days of negotiations, this week the biggest European parties have finally agreed on a series of candidates to fill the top jobs in Brussels over the next 5 years. If European Parliament approves, these newcomers will replace Jean-Claude Juncker and Donald Tusk, among other roles. So who are the candidates and what implications would their appointment have on the future Brexit negotiations? I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by Henry Newman, Director of Open Europe, and Charles Grant, Director for the Centre for European Reforms. Charles, just to start, can you give us a rundown of the most important names to know and who they are pitched to be replacing?
Well, the two most important jobs are the head of the European Central Bank, who's in charge of the euro, and the head of the European Commission, which is the EU civil service but also sets its political agenda. For the Central Bank, they've gone for Christine Lagarde, the current head of the International Monetary Fund and a former French finance minister. That's quite a controversial appointment because she's firstly a woman, there's never been a senior woman in the ECB before, but also she's not a professional economist, she's a lawyer by training. But she is economically literate and most people regard her as competent. So she's going to get the European Central Bank. Then for the European Commission, they've gone for the surprise candidate of Ursula von der Leyen, the first woman head of the European Commission, the German defence minister for the last 5 or 6 years, quite a senior heavyweight politician of perhaps a mixed track record as defence minister, but she's a convinced pro-European, quite a believer in European integration, so she will get the European Commission. The foreign policy chief will be Josep Borrell, the Spanish foreign minister, former head of the European Parliament, and the European Council, that'll go to Charles Michel, a Belgian liberal.
Now, Henry, looking at first Ursula von der Leyen, this is someone who, if you look at their previous comments on Europe, is in favour of the idea of becoming more like a federalist state on the future of Europe and has been pretty critical of Brexiteers, criticising them for wishful thinking. What do you make of this person as a candidate?
Well, I think you shouldn't really be too surprised that anybody who's a candidate for the European Commission presidency has been reasonably critical of Brexiteers. I think that's pretty much to be expected. But look, I think she's got a mixed track record back in Germany. Being in charge of the German defence forces for a while, there's been a sort of series of domestic scandals, and although she's been received quite well within Europe, she's multilingual, she grew up in for part of her childhood in Brussels, and she's, as you said, at least committed to the European project and to some degree of federalism. Back at home, it's been a much more controversial appointment, particularly with Angela Merkel's coalition partners. And actually, Germany was in the unusual position of abstaining on this appointment in the European Council, which I think fooled absolutely nobody, because it's quite clear that this is an ally of Angela Merkel. She's been in her cabinet for the best part of a decade. She was at some points discussed as a possible successor to her. But clearly, Germany, having won at least the nomination of the most important job within the EU's gift, the other jobs, as Charles was saying, went to France and Belgium and Spain. I think a lot of Western and Southwestern European countries will be looking around the Eastern Bloc and thinking, well, what did we actually get out of this? Is this sort of gone back to a core group of EU countries who are controlling the main appointments?
Do you think that means we might see some of these candidates not be go all the way or be approved when the European Parliament votes?
Well, we don't know. I think that one of the interesting things about the European elections back in May was that for the first time in a long while, the two main centre-left and centre-right parties lost their grip on the majority in the Parliament. So they need to find a majority that goes beyond those two parties. There's also obviously the Eurosceptic bloc of MEPs as well, who won't be supporting either any of these candidates. So I think there'll be some sort of interesting horse trading. But I do think it's probable that she will ultimately get approved, but I think it's difficult to say.
I agree with that. I think there'll be an emerging coalition, not of the two blocs who, as Henry says, have lost the majority, the two main centre-left, centre-right blocs. They will have to join with the liberal bloc in the middle, which Macron is the dominant figure in, plus perhaps the Greens as well. There's a majority of those four blocs work together for moderate pro-European policies. I think the most significant thing about these appointments is it's the end, at least for now, of the so-called Spitzenkandidaten system. Exactly. The system which gave us the wonderful Jean-Claude Juncker, the system whereby automatically the party which wins the most number of MEPs gets its lead candidate shoved in as Commission President. That's why we got Mr. Juncker. He was the lead candidate of the European People's Party last time round. This time, very few people really wanted Manfred Weber, the rather underwhelming candidate of the European People's Party. So we've gone back to the heads of government stitching up deals themselves. And I think most governments are happy with that. Most electors aren't even aware of what the Spitzenkandidaten system is. The European Parliament's a bit myth, but I ultimately can't really reject a woman with fairly strong credentials. I don't think they will reject a woman.
I think exactly right. I mean, I was in Germany a few months back, just before the European elections, and it was noticeable that all around Berlin were plastered these sort of posters of the different candidates for, I mean, they take their European elections perhaps more seriously than any other European country does. And there's been quite a bit of disquiet in Germany about this idea of a sort of stitch-up that's moved away from this principle that the single biggest European party in the European Parliament would be able to choose the candidate for the Commission. But that only ever happened under President Juncker, and I think it was a mistake. It was an attempt to try and sort of force through this idea of a European political demos in a way that wasn't really allowed in the treaties. Obviously, Cameron clashed very badly over this while he was still prime minister. And I think that although this appointment is being criticised as a backroom stitch-up around the council, what people like Eurosceptics like me would thought would be better would be for elected governments to be making these decisions. And then finally, you have these nominations ratified by the parliament, but the decisions should lie with governments who are accountable to their people.
Now, looking to what impact these appointments could have in terms of the UK's exit from the EU, will this new cohort make any difference to future Brexit negotiations, Charles?
I would say very little difference. Obviously, the appointment of the new head of the European Central Bank makes no difference because she will not play a role in the Brexit negotiations. The two people who matter for the Brexit negotiations are the new chairman of the European Council, the former Belgian PM Charles Michel, and Ursula von der Leyen, the new commission, or likely new commission president. They could make a difference, but I don't think they will. Firstly, well, for two reasons. I mean, firstly, with the current setup, you have Mr. Juncker, who's been quite tough on the British, though helpful in recent months, trying to get the deal over the line, being replaced by somebody who may well be less tough on the British. Mrs. von der Leyen seems to be sympathetic to the British generally, and like many Germans, hugely regrets Brexit. But then you'll have a European Council president, Donald Tusk, who's desperate for the British to stay in the EU, replaced by Charles Michel, who's closer to the Macron position, which is the British should get a move on and get out quickly, or at least sooner rather than later. So that, as before, we have one sympathetic to us, one a bit less sympathetic. But really, the second reason why this doesn't make much difference is, ultimately, policy on Brexit is made by Paris, Berlin and the key European capitals, some others like the Dutch and the Spanish chipping in. The Commission is the servant of the council in this respect. It has some influence over the details of the negotiations, but we're living, as Henry already alluded to, in an increasingly intergovernmental European Union where the federal institutions like the Commission, possibly the Parliament, will be less important than they used to be. And so if Paris and Berlin want to keep the same policy on Brexit as they've been pushing for the last few years, I don't think the change of personnel in Brussels makes much difference to the policy pushed by the EU, and I don't see that policy likely to change.
Well, exactly as Charles was saying, if it's France and Germany, Paris and Berlin, which are shaping the structure of the Brexit negotiations, of course, with Dublin as well. But I think the interesting thing here, of course, is that that's symbolised by these appointments, which ultimately were a Franco-German stitch-up, some would say, if you were trying to be pejorative, or agreement. Those two key states are the most important ones to get into line. And I think these institutions, whoever the titular heads of them, won't make that much difference in of itself, not least because actually, for example, the new president of the council won't come into place until December, by which point we may have already left, technically. However, they have some other important effects. The head of the commission will set the tone for, assuming we do leave on October the 31st, will set the tone for those negotiations on our future economic partnership if we're leaving with a deal and trying to come up with a new treaty with the EU. The other thing I think it does is it adds weight, adds ballast to that argument from Eurosceptics in the UK, who can turn to this and say, look, we've now got somebody who's a committed federalist who's spoken positively, as they see it, about a European army in charge of the Commission. Now, that may be overstated, but nonetheless, that's an argument you can run. You've got someone who is a convicted criminal who's charged with negligence in a French court running the central bank. And then you've got the guy who's going to be the high representative on foreign policy, who's been involved in various other scandals. And you've got a council president who's a former prime minister in Belgium and sort of basically lost his position in the most recent election. So you can turn to those people, and if you want to, you can construct an argument which suggests that the EU is not moving in a sort of direction where certain Remain campaigners might like to suggest that there's this possibility for Britain to stay back in the EU and to reform things. Of course, you could run a counterfactual that if Britain had actually been sitting in the room arguing for its candidates, we might have got better candidates, but that is obviously a counterfactual. But I think it slightly adds ballast to the sense that the EU is moving on in a direction without the UK. There's been some interesting sort of criticism from the Brexit Party, of course, made a lot of attention with their rather infantile stunt of turning their back on the Ode to Joy at the opening of the European Parliamentary session.
It got quite a lot of attention.
It did. I mean, I think it was all rather pathetic. But it also, what was also pathetic was the extent to which various commentators, including former candidates for Change UK, tried to draw in a direct equivalent with the Nazis, which just represented the total polarisation of our debates here in the UK, which I think is one of the big tragedies of Brexit, that we're just losing any possible sense of perspective on both ends of the scale. But what I thought was interesting as well was that the Brexit Party went out of their way to criticise these appointments and said this is all a stitch up and we're not even getting a vote on this, not realising that they would have a vote on it and they'd have a vote that these were just nominations and that they would have a vote to ratify the Commission presidency later in the game. So they revealed their own ignorance about the actual processes in the institutions to which they'd been elected.
Now, Henry, you've touched on where the power really lies in this Brexit negotiations. If you look at the, perhaps it's now reflected in these appointments, as we say, in terms of the country of origins. But when it comes to France, Germany and the European leaders that really are going to be pivotal for the next prime minister in trying to seek these concessions, Charles, do you get any sense that there is now a growing view that it is best to just get the UK out if it is going to become a more federalist project in the European Union, if it is now being led by people, if these appointments go ahead, who want it to be more like a version of the United States, that actually there is a good argument in trying perhaps to give the UK something just to make it end?
Well, I agree with half of what you said, Katie. Firstly, I don't think the EU is becoming an increasingly federalist project. I think there are people who want a much more integrated Europe, like Mr. Macron in Paris, like some of the recent appointments we've seen, such as probably Mrs. von der Leyen, perhaps the Belgian Prime Minister, who's now going to become the Council President. They would like an integrated Europe, but ultimately policy is set by the member states, and most member states, including most people in the German government, don't really want a much more integrated Europe. So I don't accept that part of your question. But on your second point, I think you're right that there is a growing sense that the British must make their mind up and mustn't be allowed to shilly-shally forever and ever. Last April, when the European Council decided whether or not to give Britain an extension, the French argued for a very short extension with no support. Almost everybody else around the Council table wanted to give the British a lot of time to make up their mind. I think now there's growing impatience with the British. Next time round, when we get to October the 31st, if the British don't have a clear plan, if they haven't left and if they don't have a clear plan for a referendum or a general election to sort things out, they just want to sort of prevaricate for another 6 months, I think Mr. Macron may have more support for his line that the British should get a move on, get out or make up their minds.
Well, I hope so, because I think it would have been actually, the problem with this extension that we're currently in is it's an anti-Goldilocks extension. It was neither short enough to force MPs to actually make a decision on the real choices, nor was it long enough to give them an opportunity to really think things through again and make up their minds. And instead, we've now had this distraction of changing the Prime Minister, which might help at some level, but isn't really addressing the fundamental problems here. And I was just come from a meeting with a senior European figure who's talking about their approach. I was running through sort of how I saw the British political landscape. And he was saying from the point of view of their capital, the withdrawal agreement isn't for reopening. And, might maybe have a little bit of tweaks around it, but there's nothing really else moving. And I was saying, well, fine, but I can't really see how the same deal is going to pass the Commons. We tried three times. We tried a cross-party deal that didn't work. And now what do you want? And I understand that the EU feels they've offered this great deal, and that's fair enough. But it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked for UK Parliament. So the choices remain a no deal, which would be damaging to all sides. We can argue about the proportion to which it would be damaging to the UK versus the rest, but it'd be damaging to both sides. A deal which would require some form of movement, or potentially no Brexit. And I think that remains very unlikely, particularly when you look at the success of the Brexit Party in the recent polls. So I think that the Europeans are very reluctant to move, and European capitals in particular don't want to move further with Britain. But equally, they are irritated by Britain's presence. But they're sort of also running away, just like our MPs are. They're running away from the actual decision about, they're not just the spectators in this. Their decisions can shape this process. And if I was advising them, I'd be saying, look, let's try and find a way through here where we can, we may not like the idea of a backstop that lasts 5 years rather than indefinitely, but it'd be better to end up with a potential for a hard border in 5 years' time rather than on October the 31st.
Henry explained why if the Europeans have any sense, they would agree to put a time limit on the backstop. Let me say why I think that is, though not inconceivable, it's highly unlikely. It's all about the Irish. If the Irish were to say, we can live with a time limit on the backstop in order to prevent the possibility of no deal, which would be really bad for Ireland, then the other 26 countries will say, OK, we'll follow the Irish. The Irish are not going to do this, at least I don't think they're going to do this. Because if they think if there's no deal, it'll be Britain's fault, they can blame the British, there'll be a hard border for a short while, then the British will come crawling back, begging for a deal because they won't be able to put up with the no-deal situation. And we forget that although Henry rightly says it's not in the EU's economic interest to allow a no-deal to happen, we forget that people don't put economics first, which is, in my view, why Brexit is happening in the first place. And many Irish people would rather have an economic hit through no-deal that causes them big problems, be able to blame the British, get some economic aid in from the EU, than actually go through the humiliation of climbing down in the face of a hardline British government and accepting a time limit on the backstop. If Leo Varadkar accepted a time limit on the backstop, he'd be toast politically at home. The Irish have become more nationalistic partly as a result of Brexit.
I think that's right. I mean, I think I'm just explaining what I thought would be a logical, sensible compromise. I think there are politics at play on all sides here, and that's part of the problem, that we've had a radicalisation on all different sides. And within Ireland, of course, the backstop is not controversial. It's supported by all the political parties. So Varadkar's not isolated in his support of the backstop. But I do think that this blame point is very important, that from the UK point of view, that will be the UK will end up blaming the EU for a no deal, and the EU will end up blaming the UK. And it's true that I think the Irish and many in the EU calculate that the UK will come crawling back to the EU for a future deal. Perhaps, but we don't know that, of course.
I agree. They may be wrong. They may have misreading the plucky Dunkirk spirit, which could take over the British.
Now, finally, we've talked of lots of jobs, and if Christine Lagarde is to leave the IMF to go for the ECB, there are reports that one of the UK's own could be lining up to replace her, and that is none other than George Osborne, currently editor of the London Evening Standard, as well as a other range of jobs. Henry, do you think that George Osborne is about to add another job to his list? I presume he'd have to leave some to take it.
Yes, it's unclear how many of his other sort of seven or eight jobs he could keep. I don't think he'd be a shoo-in. I think there'll be... There's interest from the European side for Draghi to potentially take over at the IMF. But I do think Osborne would actually be a very good appointment. And I think it'd be a good thing for the UK to have a senior British figure, a former chancellor in such an important institution. So I would be very supportive. I think he'd also clearly, he's a globalist. He's been pro-EU and also pro-China. And I think he's also clearly an Atlanticist. So I think he might tick enough of the boxes. I think it'd be a good thing for us, and I definitely support it.
Thanks, Charles. Thanks, Henry.